This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
This is a WTOP original podcast.
Coming up in this episode of Target USA.
The assassination of a Hamas leader in Beirut and an attack near the gravesite of an Iranian general. It's led to calls and cries for revenge, starting with Hezbollah and its leader.
He said this is a horrible crime of what happened and that, well, no one should be silent of this.
But Hans-Jacob Schindler, senior director at the Counter-Extremism Project, noted something interesting.
But he made no concrete threats against Israel,
creating a very complicated situation. About the killing of Arouri in Beirut, Israel has been quiet about the killing, but the operation, according to many, has the hallmarks of an Israeli operation.
You know, look, when you look at this high-value target from the Israelis' perspective, it certainly would resonate throughout the Hamas leadership, as well as the Pidge leadership and the Hezbollah leadership.
In other words, this assassination would make them very insecure. Fred Burton, former State Department counterterrorism agent, and Hans-Jacob Schindler, senior director at the Counter-Extremism Project, they both join us on this program to talk about these explosive events.
Coming up on this episode, from WTOP in Washington, D.C., this is Target USA. America has a target on its back. And on this program, we investigate the threats, the people behind them, the agencies fighting them, and the impact on you. This is Target USA.
The National Security Podcast.
I'm J.J. Green. We have two guests on this show. First up is Dr. Hans-Jacob Schindler, senior director at the Counter-Extremism Project. 2 days, two very explosive, literally, events have taken place in Lebanon and in Iran. And both of them have implications for a wider conflict in the region. We don't know a lot about either one of those situations, at least the backgrounds in terms of what took place, but that's why we come to you. So let's start first with Saleh Arouri, and then I'll ask you about the situation that took place in Kerman in Iran. But first, the killing of Saleh Arouri. What do you know?
So here is what is known, and I think also fact so far. So a couple of days ago, after a meeting between Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and Hezbollah, but after the Hezbollah officials have left, a drone strike happened at an office building where these meetings took place and killed Arouri and a couple of other Hamas guys of lesser rank. Arouri is a very significant player in the regional, even global Hamas network. He, again, is a close friend of Sinwar. Both joined Hamas very early on in 1988. Arouri was already part of the first Intifada, radicalized when he was studying at Hebron University in 1985 already, and then was one of the co-founders of the Al-Qassam Brigade, so the terror arm of the wider Hamas organization. He then was spending quite a number of years, over a decade, in Israeli prisons and was released in 2010, apparently or allegedly as part of the deal to release Gilad Shalit in 2011, although for whatever reason, Hamas subsequently denied that he was part of that deal. You can take it as what it means. But part of his release agreement was that he had to leave Israel. So he went first to the Hamas headquarters in Syria, until 2012, when Hamas and the Syrian government had a fallout because of the civil war there, and the headquarters was closed. He went then from Syria to Turkey, got thrown out of Turkey in 2015, went to Qatar, got thrown out of Qatar, and you know that Qatar is quite generous to Hamas people. So getting him out of Qatar, he must have done something really heinous, and then spent, until his death, most of his time in Beirut. Now, here he had two main functions. Number one, he was the quasi-representative of Hamas with Hezbollah. as we had said prior in our interviews, Hamas was really trained by Hezbollah. In particular, when you look what happened on the 7th of October, that's not a typical Hamas tactic. That's a typical Iranian proxy, i.e. Hamas tactic. And he was one of the main go-in-betweens between Iran and Hamas. And there are videos of him attending meetings with the supreme leader of Iran, Ali Khamenei. So not everyone gets to meet the supreme leader. You must be a really significant person to do that. So he was then also the leader of Hamas in the West Bank until his death, and the deputy of the political bureau of Hamas, so the top political leadership.
Okay, let's go back. That's quite a bit of information. So let's go back to the sort of the beginning to talk about, you said the information you have, most of it is pretty much fact. You said he was killed in a drone strike. Israel has not said they did it. Why does everyone think they did do it?
Well, first of all, Israel never, unless they're really forced or is absolute evidence that they were, ever confirming killings of terrorists abroad. Only in the Palestinian territories or in Israel do they take responsibility. Secondly, everything points towards Israel, including, of course, statements by Israeli politicians. So the head of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the Israeli parliament tweeted and congratulated the IDF, the Mossad, and the Shin Bet, or the external and internal intelligence service of Israel. But also Mark Regev, the senior advisor to Prime Minister Netanyahu, went on an American TV channel and said, whoever did it, I don't know who did it, this was not intended to target Hezbollah or the Lebanese state. So he doesn't know who did it, but he knows exactly who it was targeting. So obviously, they're not going to officially say they've done it, but it's pretty absolutely clear that it is Israel.
Now, and you're exactly right. I saw that statement by Regev, and I said, that's just a sideways confirmation of what it is that took place, although the Israelis will never, as you said, admit that they did that. Looking at Aruri being thrown out of all of these places, and I just want to drill down a little bit on why. What kind of individual was he, to your knowledge?
Because he was a top Hamas leader, and he was a top Hamas leader primarily involved in organizing violence. So this was not a Hamas leader who take care of political affairs or organizing some quote-unquote charitable operations in Gaza. His job was to organize violence. His job was to liaise with Hezbollah, to get Hamas fighters trained, to liaise with Iran, to get weapons from Iran. He was involved in financing of the Hamas, but on the violence side of Hamas. So he was as much a terrorist as you can, be a terrorist. And I think this was even for Qatar, who has very much different standards than we have of who is a terrorist and who is not, too much.
Now that this has taken place, we know that Hezbollah has promised retaliation, and we don't know when or where that will come from. But also on top of that, today at the gravesite or near the gravesite of Qasem Soleimani on the fourth anniversary of his killing in a U.S. drone strike in 2020, there was what is known in the terrorism or counterterrorism community as a double tap. There was an explosion not too far from his grave, and then 15, 20 minutes later, there was another one. Tell me what your understanding is of what took place.
Yeah. So just on the Hezbollah side, I would put a little caveat on, saying that there's going to be retaliation. So if you look at what Nasrallah has said today in his speech, it was a speech that was pre-scheduled, and there's also the connection to Kerman, pre-scheduled for the fourth year anniversary of the death of Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian Al-Quds Force general who was killed at Baghdad Airport 4 years ago. In that speech, he, number one, repeated again that this attack of October 7th was a wonderful thing, but it was not a Palestinian idea. That definitely doesn't mean that Hezbollah is eager, even at this point, to get involved in this. Secondly, he said this is a horrible crime of what happened, and no one should be silent about this, but he made no concrete threats against Israel. Again, indicating that neither Hezbollah nor Iran are willing to do more or significantly more or sustainably more than they're doing right now in order to help Hamas. So pinpoint attacks, slightly ramping up the pressure at the northern front of Israel, and 90,000 Israelis have been evacuated from northern Israel because of the Hezbollah rockets. That's as far as they are willing to go at this point. The real pressure that Iran does on the international community actually happens further south at this point. It's not the rockets on northern Israel, which is horrible and a real problem for Israel. But what the Houthis are doing in the Red Sea on Iran's behest, and Iran said a weekend ago that they are, you know, if things go wrong, going to close the Mediterranean, which means they are going to ask the Houthis to do much more to attack international shipping. And that really harms the global economy. There are several shipping lines, including Maersk, who are avoiding the Suez Canal, which means there is a drop, a significant drop in revenues for Egypt. There is a significant increase in shipping insurance, and there is a significant delays in the transport of goods and materials between Europe and Asia, Asia and America, because they're no longer going through the Suez Canal. So this is an actual, this is where the real damage for the global economy is happening right now. So now to Kerman. We really don't know yet who is behind this attack. But I like to point out, Iran is not a liberal democracy and everyone is free to do whatever they want and weapons are freely available. This is an extremely tightly controlled police state. This is a dictatorship. And so someone at a very significant public event for the regime, so this was not an opposition demonstration, this was 100% a regime show of force. It's the fourth anniversary of the death of Soleimani. It was a big event at the gravesite and at the funeral site of Soleimani planned, with thousands and thousands of regime supporters attending. And here, two bomb explosions, which means a really sophisticated planning, obtaining of explosive materials, the placement of the bombs, and killing of over 100 people and injuring scores more. That is an event that Iran has not experienced in a very, very, very long time. I do not remember a terror attack. And as you know, I served in Iran between 2005 and 11 in my time or since at that scale. There were smaller scale terror attacks at my time. There are smaller scale terror attacks always at the border between Iran and Afghanistan, sometimes at the northern part of Iran towards Iraq. But this is really unprecedented. And at the moment, the bets are still off who's behind this.
So when you look at what we know and what you just said about this being an unprecedented attack and indicating that Iran has enemies internally and it needs to watch its back internally, who's likely behind this?
It's hard to say. I mean, clearly there has been a quite a significant increase of the threat by Salafi terrorism emanating out of Afghanistan. As a reminder, Iran is a Shiite country. Inside Afghanistan, we do have groups, in particular the Islamic State Khorasan province, or the ISIS affiliate in Afghanistan, that is just as happy killing Shiites than it is as killing anyone else. And they have been attacking Iranian targets inside Afghanistan for a while. There's been already an attack with knives in Mashhad a couple of years ago, a year and a half ago, coming from Afghanistan. So if I, without knowing anything about the background at this point, this would be my first assumption. But of course, it's really hard to tell if you don't know more details. The problem with the Iranian regime is anything coming out of its propaganda machine that dresses up as a media machine is really not trustworthy. So they will come up with some culprits. I'm sure in the next 48 hours, we'll see some arrests. Some people will make confessions, and that can be true or it cannot be true. It's just impossible to tell, because in the Islamic Republic, it's not about who's done it. It's just about how the regime looks like. So I guess the usual suspects are going to be arrested and are going to confess to this crime.
So they haven't tried to blame Israel for this already, the Iranian state television or anything?
Not to my knowledge, but just wait.
Yeah. So retaliation, again, you know, that's the big thing with organizations and groups like this. They will most likely try to go after whoever did this. in some way. But I suspect, though, they're going to try to leverage this as well to try to gain support from others. I'm speaking about Iran here. How do you believe, how do you think they might try to use this to their advantage, the government?
Well, this is a very tense situation. The Iranian regime, unfortunately, is usually strategically quite smart in what it does. So rather than lashing out in the next 48 hours, I would say the Iranians are more sophisticated than that. After the killing of Soleimani, it took a year and a half before the real serious Iranian action came. So if it was anyone but Islamist terrorists out of Afghanistan, if there was anyone else behind it, or if the regime decides to spin it that way, it will take some time, but there will be a response. But immediately responding is not the style of the Iranian regime.
What is it that the U.S., the West, and others that might be allied with Israel and against Iran and against Hezbollah and against Hamas, what is it that these countries and governments and political organizations need to worry about?
Well, first of all, we still have this continuing chance, threat, risk of regional escalation. At the moment, you know, after the speech of Nasrallah, I would say the chances that Hezbollah is going to go into a full-out war with Israel and then having the same experience that it did in 2006, where it may win on the propaganda front, but it will lose most of its infrastructure that it has, is not extremely likely. Hezbollah has to make sure that it keeps the power balance in Lebanon. Hezbollah is acting on Iran's behest, who's clearly not interested to escalate this in a point where there is a chance of direct attacks against the Iranian homeland. And it has this other ability with the Houthis in Yemen, something that there is great hesitation to touch, right? So we have this international maritime force. They have shot down rockets that are very cheap with extremely expensive rockets. They have sunk some Houthi boats, but they have not, interestingly, bombarded any Houthi launch sites inside Yemen. Clearly, at this point, the international community does not want to get involved in the Yemen conflict, potentially because they've seen what happens if you do on the experience of Saudi Arabia and the UAE. But this is where the actual choke point is at the moment. And this economic damage that is done now, and for Europe, you have to take into consideration, we still have a massive war going on in Ukraine, which ramps up energy prices. The last thing that European economies need now is transport and supply chain difficulties from other areas of the globe. So this is a real flashpoint right now, and this needs to be sorted out. And I think this is where Iran sees the Achilles heel of our system at the moment, and where they can very effectively, even more removed than it would be if Hezbollah attacks, exert enormous pressure.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
That's a broad overview of what's taken place in the last couple of days. Now, for the drill down into terrorism and the tactics, tradecraft, etc., and what to expect in terms of retaliation and where and how, we go to Fred Burton. Fred is the former deputy director at the Diplomatic Security Services Counterterrorism Bureau. They're part of the State Department, and he's currently executive director of Protective Intelligence at ONTIC. And I asked him to break down what he saw in the killing of Salah Arouri in Beirut.
Well, you look at it from a counterterrorism perspective, it certainly was a very tactical operation. It, in all probability, required eyes on the target from a counterterrorism operational perspective. I also find it very interesting that the target was on the Rewards for Justice program list, which was a program that literally, we started on my watch back in the day, JJ. So this was a gentleman that had a long history of enemies, and you know, certainly not only of interest to the United States government, but obviously to the IDF as well.
That's exactly right. And I wanted to hearken back to your days at the State Department's Diplomatic Security Service. Tell us about what you know about Al-Aruri.
Well, it looks like he has a very interesting position now, I would say, from a current perspective, in that he's hunkered down in Beirut, obviously under the Hezbollah protective umbrella, which certainly provides him, it would have psychologically, with a degree of what he would perceive security in the area. And it would be that, JJ, from my understanding of just operational capability in Beirut, it was always a very difficult environment for us to operate in. There is always historical concern for, you know, the bombings that happened in 83 and 84, you know, the embassies and the Marine barracks and so forth. But when you look at that just from operating a denied area and the Israelis having that kind of tactical capability, which they've always shown to be able to do that, I hearken back to the hit on Ali Hassan Salameh of Black September in Beirut in the 70s. You know, that again was a very difficult operating environment. And, you know, look, when you look at this high value target from the Israelis' perspective, it certainly would resonate throughout the Hamas leadership, as well as the PIDG leadership and the Hezbollah leadership, which I find interesting simply because you really are rattling the Hezbollah cage now. Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah, I would think, would have to retaliate in some capacity. And the thing that is worrisome to me in that, obviously the logical target sets would be missiles raining on Tel Aviv, for example. But there's a side of me that says with the anniversary tomorrow of the assassination of IRGC General Qasem Soleimani, that timing is kind of very curious for some degree of retaliation. And I've been around this business long enough, JJ, to know that that retaliation has always surprised us. And that's a little bit worrisome to me. Obviously, Israel's the logical target, but it would not necessarily have to be inside of Israel. It could be an Israeli target somewhere else.
So this individual goes back to the early 1990s, and I believe you were still a part of the State Department at that point, the Diplomatic Security Service. So give me your view on his impact during your watch, and he was a young person then. Give me your view of his impact on the terrorism world at that time.
Well, it's interesting to me, if you harken back in those days, remember we had the Middle East peace conferences going on, you know, running all around, either having events inside the United States, most notably in the DC area, as well as diplomatic junkets around trying to have peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And we have Arafat visiting the United States during this time period, who we protected, along with a range and host of different Israeli leaders, from Rabin to Peres to General Sharon, and the list goes on. And then you look at the organization in that time period. In order to get on the Rewards for Justice list, there's a process, and it's an interagency process, meaning JJ and Fred just can't unilaterally put an individual like him on that list. And so you're going to be coordinating with state, CIA, the FBI, and DOD, and placing individuals that you believe have U.S. blood on their hands, that are in a leadership kind of role, or are trigger pullers. And, you know, the process is very well vetted. There's a lot of oversight on who goes on that list and so forth. And, you know, with this individual, you had a $5 million bounty on his head, which certainly wasn't at the bin Laden range, but it was enough to hopefully draw somebody out that might say, this is where I know the individual is, and so forth. But, you know, look, as you step back and think about this, JJ, you know, the interesting aspect is, you know, the Israelis, the Mossad, you know, they have been laser fixated on Iran and the nuclear development program, and all of a sudden the war starts, and there's a surprise element for what took place, which we still don't have good answers for. But there's going to be some historical targeting profiles of Hamas leaders, Palestinian Islamic Jihad leaders, PIJ leaders, Hezbollah leaders that you're going to pull off a shelf, and you're just going to update your targeting profile. So, you know, the ability for the Israelis to operate inside of Hezbollah's stronghold from a counterintelligence perspective is going to cause a lot of ripples throughout the Hezbollah security apparatus. And they're going to be looking for informants. They're going to be looking for individuals that perhaps assisted the IDF in this operation. I know the IDF hasn't claimed credit for it. Having said that, they're the most logical persons to pull the trigger in this case.
Yeah, one other really quick thing on this, Fred. The impact on the United States and what people have been talking about for a while inside the FBI and beyond about the chatter here in the US essentially being at unprecedented levels since this conflict, this phase of the conflict between Israel and Hamas exploded literally on the 7th of October. How do you think the killing of Arouri is going to impact things here in the US?
I think Arouri's killing is certainly going to resonate and inspire the possibility for some degree of a lone actor threat. Meaning, I do think that the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force, since 9/11, which has been a long time now, have done a wonderful job at kind of breaking the back of organized terror here in the continental United States, JJ. Having said that, this kind of event could spark some lone actor as a call for carrying out some sort of attack. I think that's your more probable kind of scenario. I don't see any organized terror here in the United States coming as a result of this. I would be much more worried if I was still back in Washington, sitting at my seat as the deputy chief in the counterterrorism division. I would be more worried about where has Hezbollah surprised us in the past. And where are those locations? And, you know, off the top of my head, they hit us in Latin America. They had a very sophisticated car bomb we uncovered in Bangkok back in the day. And, you know, that's to me is the more worrisome part. You have a tactical threat here locally from lone actors inspired, then the strategic threat would be someplace that we least expect it to happen.
Anything you want to add that I haven't asked you about that you think is important?
Well, I think the next 72 hours will be telling how quickly can Hezbollah and/or Hamas mount some sort of retaliation. In the near term, I look for some degree of an elevated missile threat on Tel Aviv, but then in the next 72 hours, especially with the anniversary of General Soleimani's assassination, if there's anything in the works, now would be the time to pull the trigger.
That's it for this episode of Target USA. Coming up in our next episode. On Christmas Eve, I got a surprise phone call from Paul Whelan, calling from prison. Just days away from being incarcerated wrongfully in Russia for 5 years, Paul Whelan has a special message for President Biden.
Mr. President, you promised to bring me home. I'm still here.
And he says with each passing year, it's going to get harder.
In hostage situations, the longer they are allowed to go on, the more complicated and harder it is for them to be resolved.
And he said it's taking a huge toll on him.
I'm quite depressed, as a matter of fact. I mean, it's Christmas time. I'm away from family. You know, I've been here 5 years. I'm surrounded by criminals. You know, it's not a healthy environment.
That's coming up on the next episode of Target USA. In the meantime, if you have any questions or comments about the program, send me an email. You can reach me at jgreen@wtop.com. The letter J, the color green, one word, at Whiskey Tango Oscar Papa. jgreen@wtop.com. Also, please subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Twitter. We're at TUSA Podcast. That's at Tango Uniform Sierra Alpha Podcast. And if you want more national security news, you can sign up for my newsletter. It's called Inside the SCIF, and you can sign up at WTOP.com/email.
I'm J.J. Green, and this is Target USA,
the National Security Podcast.